Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record, program number 299, an update on German corporate control over the American media. We're going to be taking a look at a number of different aspects of this long and, I believe, critically important series that I've been doing for quite some time. Well, this program is being recorded on May 6th of the year 2001, and we're going to be touching a number of bases, including some really, really important events that have taken place or may take place and which have really, really huge implications for the world of telecommunications, the internet, and mobile cell phones in particular. We're going to begin with a continuation of what we were looking at the end of For the Record program number 298. That was also recorded on May 6th of 2001. By the way, all of the For the Record programs are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire, and many of them are available on real audio files that are made available on the website of sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. One of those websites is wfmu.org/Dave Emery. The other one is a longer web address, which, time permitting, I will give you at the end of this program. There is a link to both websites, both of the WFMU web addresses, on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. And you can click on the For the Record section, and in addition to long annotated descriptions of the For the Record programs, or at least annotated for the last year, long descriptions annotated for the last year, there are links to the WFMU websites. At the conclusion of For the Record program number 298, we were looking at the increasing fortunes of BarnesandNoble.com. We've been talking about the Bertelsmann firm, which appears to be a Bormann company. Bertelsmann owns a little less than 50% of BarnesandNoble.com, and BarnesandNoble.com is gaining very rapidly on Amazon.com in online book sales. Now, note that publishing and book sales are distinct, but through BarnesandNoble.com and other online used book services, Bertelsmann is gaining in the field of book sales as well. Whether or not it's directly relevant to this series, I believe it might be. There was a curious detail that arose in connection with a recent antitrust suit that was concluded. It was settled out of court. Barnes & Noble was one of the companies that was a defendant in this suit. The San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, April 20th of the year 2001, had an article about this suit and the settlement of it. The article is by Bob Egelko, or Egelko, E-G-E-L-K-O, and Michael McCabe. Its headline, Chapter Ends for Booksellers. The article reads in part as follows. Independent bookstores were dealt a crushing blow yesterday when their trade group settled an antitrust lawsuit with an accord widely considered a victory for two of America's biggest book chains. The American Booksellers Association gave up the fight during the second week of a San Francisco federal court trial in which it had argued that Barnes & Noble Incorporated and Borders Group Incorporated used their weight to force publishers to offer discounts and benefits unavailable to mom-and-pop shops. This particular lawsuit, the settlement of it, does not bode well for smaller independent book chains. What was not mentioned in that article or most of the other stories that I saw was who represented Barnes & Noble. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the Palo Alto Daily News of Tuesday, April 10th of the year 2001. This is an AP story, Dateline San Francisco, headlined Indie Booksellers Open Case Against Big Chains. And it mentions the counsel for Barnes & Noble, and this is a name that will ring familiar to people familiar with the O.J. Simpson case. Daniel Petrocelli, representing Barnes & Noble, said the independent booksellers' claims of unfair or illegal discounts for the chains are inflated and inaccurate. Well, this may be irrelevant under the circumstances. On the other hand, perhaps not. I would note that it was the O.J. Simpson case which unfolded while I read the book Serpent's Walk, which somebody had sent me. I was not aware that Serpent's Walk existed. Somebody, a listener, sent me the book, and I read it while the O.J. Simpson case was going on. I had read Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile back in the 1980s, and it was reading Serpent's Walk while watching the O.J. Simpson drama unfold that convinced me that Serpent's Walk was real. I knew that parts of it were real, and watching the media endorse a view of an event that could not have happened the way it was represented as happening led me to the conviction that Serpent's Walk was quite real. It was, to a certain extent, an intuitive or subjective consideration, but it was the O.J. Simpson case and the reading of Serpent's Walk simultaneously that convinced me to go with this line of inquiry, and I believe that subsequent circumstances have borne it out quite effectively. I would also note that it was a German production company that developed the Frogman series, which was manipulated in such a way, stills from it, as to lend credence to the viewpoint that O.J. Simpson had committed the murders. I would also note that in the book Blood Oath, it's alleged that the Cause Group, Christian Aryan Underground Special Enforcers Strike Team, which committed the killings of Ron and Nicole, was financed from a foreign country, and the description made it appear as though that was probably Germany, although that's not definitive. There was a recent statement by the German Interior Minister, Otto Schily, that has enormous implications for the Internet. It remains to be seen just what exactly takes place with regard to this particular threat. But Interior Minister Otto Schily, in a rather odd twist of events, is threatening DOS attacks on American Internet servers that carry Nazi material. It could open up a huge, huge precedent. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from Wired Magazine. This is an article titled, German Threat Raises Infowar Fear. It's authored by Steve Kettmann, K-E-T-T-M-A-N-N, state-lined April 9th, 2001, or it's dated April 9th, 2001, date-lined Berlin. It reads in part as follows. The Germans are planning an attack. At least, that's the threat that Interior Minister Otto Schily has made, vowing the German government may resort to denial-of-service attacks as a way to shut down U.S. and other foreign websites that help German neo-Nazis. Condemnation of the plan was immediate, but as of Monday afternoon in Germany, Schily's office had reported no backtracking from his statement, which has been the focus of recent media attention in Germany. Skipping down. If I said something like this in public as a speaker of the Chaos Computer Club, I could count the minutes before I had an investigation against me, said Andy Mueller Magun, M-A-G-U-H-N, leader of Berlin's famed CCC hacker group, and also Europe's representative on the ICANN board. Quote, it may be that Mr. Schily does not know anything about Infowar, but I know a lot of countries see attacks coming at their computers from other countries as an act of war. If even one country in the world were to start acting like this, it could lead to an open info war that no one could win, unquote. Schily regularly makes headlines in Germany with his denunciations of far-right groups who have grown not only more numerous over the last year, but also more violent. In fact, the government announced last month that in 2000 the number of far-right crimes reached its highest level since World War II. Schily believes right-wing websites, increasingly based in the United States, foment this violence. Last December, Germany's Supreme Court ruled that German law could be applied to material placed on the Internet and available in Germany, raising the possibility of German legal action against Americans sponsoring such sites. Skipping down. But in delving into such sensitive territory as a government sponsoring DOS attacks, Schily may stir up more controversy than he realizes. Quote, I don't think he knows what a Pandora's box he's opening, said Frank Rieger, a longtime member of the Berlin hacking scene who last year co-founded a Berlin startup. Again quoting, if even one American ISP decides to say, we are being attacked by a foreign government and we are going to a counterattack, they have much bigger resources, so that could be really devastating. There wouldn't be much bandwidth left, because there is not as much bandwidth here in Germany as there is in the United States. If it all sounds far-fetched, maybe it should. But that does not mean Schily floated the idea without being serious about it. His office did not return repeated calls for comment, but Mueller Magoon has established the existence of a recent letter signed by Schily himself outlining the DOS plan in detail. The letter says such an attack would not violate the law, Mueller Magoon said, again quoting, watching the situation, it might be that I have to start an investigation against Mr. Schily because of two things. One is promoting illegal things in public. You're not allowed to tell people to do something illegal. And the other thing is a little bit worse. German law says if you prepare an act of war, that's something quite serious. A number of things to note in that context. First of all, as the article, I think, makes very clear, it opens the possibility of the German government conducting DOS attacks on American internet servers could vary, or internet providers could open a huge can of worms. I also think that it is deflecting responsibility for the rise of fascism in Germany away from the very profound reasons in Germany. And this is not to say, however, that there are not profound connections between German and American Nazi elements. There are, and those links are not in any way to be downplayed, and I've discussed those on numerous broadcasts. However, to lay the blame for German fascism on American fascists is rather far-fetched under the circumstances and serves to deflect the blame away from Germany. And this, again, is not to minimize, once again, the profound connections between German and American fascists. Those connections go back a long way, and as I've said many times, I think part of the responsibility for fascism in Germany lies with those American industrialists and financiers who helped to finance Hitler in the first place. But that's part of the responsibility. Again, the international implications of Mr. Scheele's proposed action could not be exaggerated and could wield a profound and drastic effect on internet providers of all types, not just those that do access Nazi material. Again, it could open a huge can of worms. One wonders whether anti-fascist or anti-Nazi websites might come under attack by the German government or others. A story that I've been following for some time, specifically since For the Record program number 245, Deutsche Telekom über alles, has come to fruition, and the following story also has huge implications for international telecommunications, and in particular with regard to foreign governments buying American telecommunications companies, something that now has been, basically the door for that has been explicitly thrown open by Michael Powell, the head of the FCC. The implications of the following story could not be exaggerated. This is, I think, one of the most important news stories I've seen in a long, long time. And bear in mind, in not only For the Record program number 245, but also in broadcast number 278, I've looked at the links between Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, Matthias Wismann, the treasurer of the CDU funding scandal, Holocaust-related lawsuits, and also the opening up the globalization process on both sides of the Atlantic. We revisited that subject in For the Record program 294 as well. I have been quite open in speculating that the Bush administration, George W. in particular, and his father, are basically frontmen for the Bormann Organization, literally the economic and political component of a Third Reich gone underground. I can appreciate that that is a subject that will appear fantastic to many listeners. There are numerous broadcasts dealing with that. I would encourage listeners to examine For the Record program number 273, and For the Record program number 278, there are detailed and annotated descriptions of both programs on the Spitfire website at in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Both broadcasts can be listened to on Real Audio online at the website of WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. That is at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. I'm going to read this entire article on this broadcast. I'm going to read the entire text of it. Listen very carefully. I can appreciate that the format that I use on For the Record is very pedantic indeed. The implications of the following story could not be exaggerated and may very well exert a profound influence on the future of the United States. This is from the Financial Times of Wednesday, May 2nd of the year 2001. It's an article by Peter Spiegel in Washington. It's headlined, U.S. ruling on telecom could lead to wave of investment. Listen to this. This concerns the FCC's approval of Deutsche Telekom's takeover of VoiceStream, but the implications go way, way beyond that. And as you listen to this, bear in mind that Deutsche Telekom is controlled by the German government. This ruling opens the door for other foreign government-controlled companies to buy into the American telecommunications market. Bear in mind, for example, that Deutsche Welle, which is controlled by the German government, broadcast footage of the rioting in Los Angeles that followed the acquittal of some officers who had beaten Rodney King, this following the Northridge earthquake in 1994. They portrayed the social chaos that broke out after the verdict on the officers who beat Rodney King as taking place and exemplifying the degeneracy of America and the lack of control over American by American authorities over American society, and proving that Americans could not handle disasters and that they were a disorderly people. And again, that footage of the Rodney King-related rioting was broadcast on Deutsche Welle, controlled by the German government, after the Northridge earthquake, and was portrayed as rioting in Los Angeles following the Northridge quake. In fact, that did not take place. So keep that in mind as you listen to the following. Again, from the Financial Times of May 2nd of the year 2001, an article by Peter Spiegel in Washington headlined, U.S. ruling on telecom could lead to wave of investment. This article reads in part as follows. The importance of Deutsche Telekom's $24 billion takeover of VoiceStream, the American wireless provider to U.S. regulators, is probably best illustrated by how long the deal took to get final approval. Bear in mind, as we've looked at, the lobbying was done by Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, which has the treasurer of the CDU, Matthias Wismann, on its staff. Continuing. The Federal Communications Commission's assent last week came more than 2 weeks after an internal deadline had passed, and the FCC's formal order issued on Friday only came after an additional 2 days of wrangling. The delay was because FCC officials implied last week Telecom's purchase of a U.S. phone license was a, quote, matter of first impression, unquote. The first time the commission had ruled on foreign government stakes in U.S. carriers, and the agency's new chairman, Michael Powell, parenthetically the son of Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, was committed to produce a precedent-setting ruling. By the way, I would add that is exactly what he did. Listen to the following, and bear in mind that as the headline on the story indicates, this is seen as portending a wave of foreign investment and foreign government investment in American telecommunications. Continuing with this article. Although extended regulatory debates can frequently lead to documents full of mealy-mouthed bureaucraties, the 97-page order issued by the FCC is as sweeping and precedent-setting as Mr. Powell had wanted. It goes further than any previous ruling in the agency's 66-year history to open up the U.S. telecommunications market to foreign competitors. Quote, this is the green light. This is the paved road. This is the Autobahn, said Ruti Baca, an analyst of international telecoms regulation with the Precursor Group. It's more definitive than most people expected, unquote. At the heart of the debate over the deal was a discrete section of the Communications Act that contained seemingly contradictory guidance on how to deal with foreign telecoms owned by their governments. One part of the law states flatly that no U.S. phone licenses can be held, quote, by any foreign government or representative thereof, unquote. But another section allows a company owned by a foreign government to buy the license if the FCC rules it in the public interest. And by the way, I would add that so-called M-commerce, the use of mobile phones to access the Internet, is seen as a major element in Internet activity in the future. So this has implications way, way beyond mobile telephones, and indeed could very, very easily affect American broadcasts, the American broadcast landscape as well, ultimately. Again, the implications of this are very broad indeed. Continuing. The interpretation of the language is crucial, since outside the UK, most big overseas telecommunications companies remain at least partially in the hands of governments. After the VoiceStream deal closes, for instance, Telecom will still be 45% owned by the German government. The same is the case for important international players such as France Telecom and Japan's NTT. In its telecom voice stream ruling, the FCC found the wording calling for an outright ban applies only if a foreign government itself tries to acquire a license, a highly unlikely scenario that for all intents and purposes makes the clause moot. Instead, all companies where a government owns a stake will be governed by the public interest waiver. In addition, the FCC went even further, saying that due to trade commitments, any purchase by a company from a WTO country will be assumed to be in the public interest, a clear sign that the agency has opened the floodgates. One more time. In addition, the FCC went even further, saying that due to trade commitments, Any purchase by a company from a WTO country will be assumed to be in the public interest, a clear sign that the agency has opened the floodgates. Bear in mind that Robert Zoellick, the U.S. Trade Commissioner, is associated with the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and as a member of George I's State Department and associate of James Baker, he was instrumental in effecting the reunification of Germany, working in that regard with Günter Strassmayer, the father of Andrea Strassmayer, according to Carol Howe, the mastermind of the Oklahoma City bombing. Timothy McVeigh was his protege. Continuing, quote, "The FCC has confirmed that it will be applying U.S. law to U.S. World Trade Organization commitments, and that is a critical ruling," unquote, said Scott Blake Harris, former head of the FCC's International Bureau who worked for VoiceStream in the deal. Analysts predict that the order could lead to a new wave of foreign investment, which could target even the largest U.S. carriers. The FCC's sweeping ruling, however, has incensed the deal's opponents, including Senator Ernest Hollings, who came within a hair's breadth of blocking the merger through legislation last year. He has vowed to reintroduce the bill this session and include a provision that would force the German government to sell most of its stake in telecom if it wanted to retain VoiceStream. Quote, "They basically rewrote the law," said one congressional critic. "They just changed 65 years of jurisprudence," unquote. And I would note that Michael Powell has been a big advocate of deregulation, and the precedent cited by the FCC in this basically alluded to the World Trade Organization, and that was established in considerable measure as a result of the actions of Robert Zoellick, as we looked at in For the Record program number 273. So the shadow of Robert Zoellick, with all of his connections from the Bush State Department to the German Marshall Fund of the United States, looming large over that particular FCC ruling. In the past, we've taken a look at Bertelsmann's gaining control of a broadcaster named RTL. I'm not going to go into that at any great length. That was covered, though, in the Wall Street Journal of Wednesday, March 28th of the year 2001. This will permit Bertelsmann to retain control over its stock, although now its capital capacity is going to be increased enormously in order to the fact that part of its stock is now going to be sold. Basically, it's going to go public, but Bertelsmann will retain control. This is an article by John Carreyrou, Carreyrou, and Ken Brown, Dateline Brussels. Investors now have a back door to Bertelsmann. And the article reads in part as follows. What could possibly get investors interested in a Belgian holding company that is controlled by two 70-something tycoons and has a corporate structure that looks like a bowl of spaghetti? Answer: a backdoor way to own a stake in German media giant Bertelsmann at what some see as a bargain price. That is why investors in the U.S. and Europe are busily running the numbers on Group Bruxelles-Lambert, the Brussels-based holding company of Belgian and Canadian billionaires Albert Frère and Paul Desmarais. We took a look at this in For the Record program number 275, number 276, and also number 278 as well. And one of the major reasons why they want to gain control of RTL is discussed here. That is about to change, and all because of Bertelsmann's strong desire to gain control of RTL, Europe's biggest television and radio broadcaster. And RTL is projected as moving into the United States, as we've looked at in part of this series, on German corporate control over the American media. And it'll be interesting to see if the FCC takes a similar view to foreign ownership of television stations in the United States that it has taken with regard to foreign government ownership of telecommunications companies. In the book that I've accessed so many times, a book called Serpent's Walk, a Nazi tract that I believe to be a blueprint for the future, the goal of the Underground Reich is described in a conversation between two of the Nazi faithful, Rentsch and Lessing, as follows. Rentsch is explaining to Lessing about Underground Reich companies buying up the media. "We've swung program content around too. Not much, but a little so it won't show. We've cut down on nasty Nazi movies, good guys in white hats and bad guys in black SS hats, lovable Jews versus fiendish Germans, and we have media psychologists, ad agencies, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes. Bear that in mind as you hear the following. Research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience. This is an article from Variety. The article is from February 14th of the year 2001. This is a Reuters story. It's by John Dempsey, Dateline, New York, and it's headlined, Germans Tune Out Nazis. The article reads as follows. Never make Nazi soldiers the villains of a TV series if you're seeking German financing. That's the lesson learned the hard way by Jeff Johns, a producer of the action-adventure series Matthew Blackheart Monster Smasher, which has gone down in flames before the first episode made its way to the Sci-Fi Channel. Skipping down. In the 2-hour pilot for Monster Smasher, the Blackheart wipes out Nazis like some G.I. Joe superhero. Even though the series itself is set in present-day America, no German TV company would touch it, says Johns. A spokesman for Telemunchen denies that Nazi soldiers in the pilot had anything to do with its decision to pass on Monster Smasher and dealing with the financing of this. Johns said the first 4 episodes of 22 commissioned by Sci-Fi Channel had already been written when one of the show's financial partners, the Telecine Film Group of Montreal, declared bankruptcy 2 months ago. Again, we scrambled like crazy to find a replacement, said Johns, focusing on German firm Telemunchen Group. In the 2-hour pilot for Monster Smasher, Blackheart wipes out Nazis like some G.I. Joe superhero. Even though the series itself is set in present-day America, no German TV company would touch it, says Johns. A spokeswoman for Telemunchen denies that Nazi soldiers in the pilot had anything to do with its decision to pass on Monster Smasher. And again, that's interesting to reflect on against the background of Serpent's Walk. Returning to Serpent's Walk, more about how the Underground Reich plans on changing the image of the Third Reich through media manipulation. Skipping down, speaking of past villains, it's all how you package it. Opinion is a goddamn commodity. Remember the Pied Piper, the guy who tutored his flute, stole everybody's kids, ran off with them, and was never seen again? A child abuser. But who hates him? Now, he's a dinkin' fairy tale. Image. Just image. And it goes on to talk about how they're altering the image of the Third Reich. We play those aspects down and stress the positive ones instead. The mystique, the scientific approach to racial genetics, the efficiency and organization, the dedication, and the heroism. People will buy that. Skipping down. You'll never convince enough people to matter. And Wrench replies, give it time. Aside from the media, we've been buying up private schools and helping some public ones through philanthropic foundations and working on the churches and born-agains. So again, that is from the supposedly fictional book, Serpent's Walk. And listen to the following and reflect on this against the background of that. Conservative columnist James P. Pinkerton had a column that was run in the San Francisco Chronicle on Hitler's birthday, Friday, April 20th of the year 2001. It's called The Hot New Allure of Nazi Chic. And skipping down, we read, the forthcoming movie Tomb Raider, opening June 15th, is a case in point. It flirts with what might be called Nazi chic. The March 26th issue of Time magazine features a photo of actress Angelina Jolie playing superheroine Lara Croft. She is decked out in Terminatrix black, and on her gold belt buckle is what looks unmistakably like the skull and crossbone symbol of the Nazi Schutzstaffel or SS. That's right, the Totenkopf death's head of the German killer elite. And we're going to continue with this analysis in the next segment for the record program number 300. And we're going to deal with that in our next half hour as sort of an entree into an examination of the world of music. I've alluded to other broadcasts in this series. Those are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire, available from at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. You can access a detailed and annotated description of For the Record program number 299 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. And there are real audio archives of For the Record being compiled by WFMU at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Also on a longer site that is has a link on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. This concludes For the Record program number 299. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.